Luke 9:51-956. The 44th talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on July 23, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to go back to the Gospel of Luke. We're in chapter 9, beginning with about verse 51. Earlier in chapter 9, we're just on the heels of the event called the Transfiguration, where Jesus and three of his disciples went up on the mountain. And there's this event where the glory of Jesus' authority was revealed in this remarkable event where he meets Elijah and Moses. He comes down the mountain, and the disciples have just experienced a colossal spiritual and moral failure because of their misunderstanding of, failure of their faith, of their understanding, because they had mistakenly understood that the power that was given to them was some kind of magical power, and they had forgotten that it was God who heals, God who casts out demons, not them. And so they, when confronted with a demon-possessed young man, were unable to cast it out, of course, because they had completely lost perspective on what is going on with the miracles. And then we had the disciples who, is this close enough? Then the disciples had been arguing among themselves who is the greatest, and Jesus points out to them, as I would understand it, that greatness in the kingdom of God comes in an ironic fashion. Greatness in the kingdom of God comes from recognizing that you're not great, and points that out to the disciples. I think there's a couple of other things that have happened. But then we get to verse 51, which I think is the next unit, the next section of the Gospel of Luke. Let me talk a little bit about what's going on here in Luke. As I would read the Gospel of Luke, the way he structures his Gospel is that everything that we have been dealing with up till now and for a little bit further into the Gospel is basically in chronological order. And it's so much in chronological order that you can pretty much count on any teaching or miracle that occurs being in the time frame, in the chronological time frame that he's discussing at that point. We are shortly going to get to a section of Luke where I think that ceases to be the case. And what happens is all of his accounts start saying a certain person in a certain city, or he was in a certain village and he did this, or and he's very, very non-specific about where the event is happening, when it is happening. And I think what happens is that we have a section in Luke that actually follows an interesting statement that Luke makes where he says, what does he say? Unfortunately, it's in my notes, so I can't find it. He says something to the effect that they remembered all that he did and said, or we'll get there. They're marveling all he did and said. And I think what Luke does then is he takes all the material that he in his research has been unable to identify as to its time and place, and includes that following that. So up till now, something happened in Capernaum, or something happened in Bethsaida, or some village that he can identify on a certain occasion, but he comes to a point where he can no longer identify when that stuff happens. So he lumps it all together and includes it after a statement about all that Jesus said and did. And then after that section, we get his approach to, from Jericho to his approach to Bethany and Jerusalem and the last days of his life on earth. Now, why is that relevant to this section? It's relevant to this section because I think we're still in that chronological section. So what is occurring here is occurring at this particular time in his ministry. This is not just drawn from who knows where in his life and ministry. It's drawn from this time and place. And what we're dealing with is the time when he is in Galilee and he's decided, okay, this is it. I'm going to my death and ultimately to my glory. And I'm headed to Jerusalem in order that all those events might take place. So this is him simply finally deciding the time is now. I'm headed to fulfill my mission here on earth. So what happens is the route that he seems to take is he leaves Galilee, he passes through Samaria, part of Samaria, on his way to the other side of the Jordan. He goes down the east side of the Jordan River to makes his way eventually back over the river to Jericho and then west to Jerusalem. And we'll get to the rest of the story, which you are pretty familiar with. Okay, so let's read it. And I'll make some more comments about the background here. So this is 9:51, chapter 9, verse 51. When the days were approaching for his ascension, he strengthened his resolve to go to Jerusalem. Indeed, he sent messengers on ahead of him. Now coming to a village of the Samaritans, they entered it to make preparations for him. But they would not receive him, for his face was set to travel to Jerusalem. When his disciples James and John saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did? But he turned and rebuked them and said, you do not know of what sort of spirit you are. Now the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went on to another village. And as they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, the foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And he said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father. But he said to him, allow the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God. Another also said, I will follow you, Lord, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home. But Jesus said to him, no one, after putting his hand to the plow and then looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. Okay, this starts by saying when the days were approaching for his ascension. Now, that's a perfectly fine translation. That's the word that's used, or at least the verbal form of this word, is the word that is used for his taking up from the Mount of Olives and to sit at the right hand of the throne on high. So that would be a very appropriate translation of this. However, this verb is also used in other contexts, and this is the only place in the New Testament that actually the noun is used. So it's not like there's a well-established usage for this noun to mean his ascension. I think it's also possible, for example, when Paul is taken by the Roman army and whisked away to Caesarea to protect him, this is the verb that's used for snatching him up or taking him up. It seems to me a problem here in knowing exactly what Luke means by this noun, because it could be his ascension, certainly, but I think it could also be his being nabbed by the Roman authorities. The reason I wonder about that is, what difference does it make? I mean, since the one follows the other, and if it's time for his ascension, it's certainly time for his arrest and his death and crucifixion and resurrection and so on. In terms of the timing, it doesn't make any difference. But when it talks about him setting his face toward Jerusalem, Luke is connecting those two ideas. He set his face toward Jerusalem for what? To what end? Was it to the end of his glory? Or was it to the end of his obedience to his death on the cross? That's the only difference that I can see. I'm inclined at this point to think that the ascension was his being nabbed, his snatched by the temple guard, and that what he set his face to do was to obey his father. Now again, theologically, we know from Philippians that he endured the cross and the shame of the cross for the glory set before him. So in the ultimate analysis, he wouldn't set his face to obey his father and go to his death if it weren't that he had set his face to receive the glory that it was his due. So in the end, perhaps it really doesn't make any difference. But you get a picture, if it's his arrest and his eventual death, then you get a picture of his stark determination to be obedient to the mission that his father had given him. And if that's the case, it presents a very important model for us, that that whatever it means, whatever it costs, whatever the implications for us, obedience to our Father is the crucial way to live our lives. And we see that modeled here if his determination was to go to his death and be obedient. But in any case, his face was set. I think I translated it. He strengthened his resolve to go to Jerusalem. And so that's the time in his life. He's been ministering in Galilee. Now's the time to go die. So he begins the journey back to Jerusalem, to his death. He sent messengers ahead of him, and in the first part of their journey, they were going through Samaria. So they come to a village of the Samaritans. They enter to make preparations for him, and what that means is they're looking for houses that will house them, people that will extend hospitality to them, feed them, give them a place to stay for the night, and so on. Especially in the villages and the rural areas, that was the only way you could travel. Their inns were relatively rare. There were some, but they were relatively rare. So if people in the village did not open up their homes and extend hospitality, then a traveler had no place to stay. So there was a cultural expectation that you would open up your home and that somebody in the village would extend hospitality. So they go into this village to try to find those homes that will accept them. But the text says, but they would not receive him, for his face was set to travel to Jerusalem. Okay. That's a curious statement. We know from history that a large part of what's happening here is a kind of ethnic tension. This is a racial issue, an ethnic issue. The Samaritans are the Samaritans, and the Jews are the Jews, whether Judean or Galilean. I mean, the Judeans even had a little bit of trouble with the Galileans, because the Galileans were country hicks compared to the urbane Judeans. So there's even some kind of prejudice for the Galileans, but at least they're Jews. But the Samaritans are not acceptable to the Jews. I mean, if you think it's along the lines, without the technology, without the weaponry, without the military conflict, it's along the lines of the Arab-Jewish conflict in the Middle East today, that there is a great deal of tension between Jews and Samaritans, so much so that it's unusual that Jesus is even transversing Samaritan territory to get to Jerusalem. That was not typically done. Typically, the Jews would take a circuitous route, go to the east of the Jordan and down the Jordan and not set a foot in Samaria because they were just that, there's that much hostility. But Jesus ignores that hostility on a number of occasions in his ministry. The racism, the ethnic prejudice is of no consequence to him. He doesn't believe that they are lesser people in any way. He doesn't hate them. So he's going through this, the disciples are going to this village, and the Samaritans won't receive them because they're going to Jerusalem. Now, what's interesting is it doesn't say they won't receive them because they're Jews. I mean, that would be historically understandable. That might be a reason in and of itself why a Samaritan village wouldn't receive them. But it says they wouldn't receive them because he was going to Jerusalem. He had his face was set to travel to Jerusalem. I think even though they're Jews, Jesus has ministered enough in Samaria that the Samaritans themselves are intrigued by this person, Jesus. I mean, you know the famous story of the woman at the well in Samaria. Jesus has gained a bit of a reputation in Samaria as well as among the Jews in Judea and Galilee. So they wouldn't mind having him around, healing, doing the miracles that he did in Galilee. And here he is in their midst, and he's available to them to perform those miracles and bless them in the same way that he's blessed the Jews up in Galilee and Judea. And yet he's determined to pass through, travel through, and not linger, not stay. He's going to go to the stinking Jews down in Judea. So they're offended by that. Yeah, we could show you hospitality if you'd hang around for a while, but if you're just going to use us as a stopping point to pass through to go minister to the Jews, then forget that. We're not interested in that. So selfish, self-centered, sure, but like us, you know, very understandable. So on that basis, they will not extend hospitality to him. So James and John respond. When his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did? Some of the Greek texts do not have the just as Elijah did part, but I see nothing about that as being implausible. It makes sense to me. I included it in my translation because I think it probably is authentic. Do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just as Elijah did? Now, the danger here is that we're not going to identify with James and John here. And I think there's no way we can understand the import of this event unless we do identify with them. The reason we won't identify with them is that calling down fire from heaven is not our style of revenge. That's not typically what we think in terms of. That's not how we get back at people. But I think we have to put ourselves in the time and place of James and John. They've watched several years of Jesus doing incredibly remarkable things, things that would rival the prophets in the Old Testament. And James and John, familiar with the account of Elijah on Mount Carmel, where after this contest with the priests of Baal, in the end, the fire comes down and devours the altar and everything on it and all the ground around it and so on. They're familiar with the power of God to do this. So they're thinking something along the lines of, you're the Son of Man. These people just dissed you. These people just rejected you. These people in their selfishness are not even willing to show hospitality to you, and you're the Son of Man. And people that are not received, or people that do not receive the Son of Man, are damnable people. They are subject to condemnation. And don't you think it would be important, Jesus, to send this message that you don't want to be rejecting the Son of Man? How about a little Elijah action and let's call some fire down from heaven to just devour the whole village? How about that? Now, it sounds silly to us from our perspective, but I think this was a relatively serious proposal on their part. They're not just talking. They're not just venting. This is not just words coming out of their frustration. I want to talk more about that in a second. This is a settled desire within their heart, is that these people be destroyed for what they just did. That something like that is their reasoning. Now, what's curious to me about this event is that we just finished the account of the demon-possessed boy, that the disciples were unable to cast it out, and Jesus comes to them and says, look, these things, it requires prayer in order to cast out demons. And what he's saying is, you guys don't have the power to command demons. Only God has the power to command demons. I don't even have the power to command demons, I think Jesus would say. My Father commands demons. And it's only as he wills to accomplish these remarkable things do these things happen. They're not at our discretion. So I think here James and John haven't even really fully learned the lesson of that last event. At least they have the sense to go tell Jesus to call down fire from heaven and not try it themselves. But I don't think they fully grasped what Jesus was trying to tell them at that point. And that was, look, if God doesn't want to devour this village, I can't make it happen. I don't have that kind of power at my discretion, at my disposal. I mean, that we've seen that over and over again now through Luke. And I know it cuts across some of our understanding of the deity of Jesus, that the deity of Jesus consisted of him having at his own discretion all the power of God. But Jesus explicitly denies that over and over and over again. I didn't do that. I didn't do that on my initiative. I only do what I see the Father doing. I only say and speak what I hear the Father speak. He was utterly and completely a human being dependent upon God as his creator in everything that he said, everything that he taught, and everything that he did. And that's his own self-portrait that he offers to us. Was he God? Yes. but not in the sense that he was not man. He was a man who was God. And what we see when it comes to his miracles is not his deity. What we see when it comes to his miracles is a man in his humanity who has the authority to be the Messiah himself, the Son of God himself, the firstborn of all creation. That's what we're seeing in Jesus. But what's interesting is Jesus doesn't respond with, well, I can't do that unless I see the Father doing it. I don't have the authority to call down fire from heaven. He doesn't say that. What he says instead is, he rebukes them, you do not know of what sort of spirit you are. Now the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. He cites his own life, his own person, his own desires as an example to James and John. And his own life both exposes the evil in their heart on the one hand, and then and rebukes them at the same time. What's really motivating James and John? Ostensibly, in their own thinking, their theology is probably exactly right on. People who reject the Son of Man are damnable. And if they're damnable, then Jesus, we can ask God to condemn them and to damn them. But I think what Jesus recognizes is that James and John are actually being motivated by something else, and that's why they're rebuked by his comment. James and John are themselves personally feeling dissed by these Samaritans. They're being unacknowledged. They're disciples of Jesus. They're disciples of the Son of Man. And yet these Samaritans just blew them off and wouldn't show them hospitality. And probably the racial element was clearly there as well. These Samaritans, these stinking Samaritans, had the audacity to disrespect them. So their response is to wish ill upon those people who have shown them personal disrespect and who have personally insulted them and pained them and hurt them. It's a very, very natural response. And that's the part that I hope will resonate with us. You know, all the calling down fire from heaven sounds so fanciful that it removes it from us. But we may not call down fire from heaven, But don't you feel the tug in your heart to hurt the people who have hurt you, to get back at them, to get revenge, to have something show them for what they are? It's a very natural response, but it's evil. And that's what Jesus is wanting them to see. That's an evil response. We readily feel ill will toward anyone and everyone who fails to acknowledge us in a way that pleases us. We readily do that. But to feel that way is very unlike Jesus. It's very unlike the Son of Man. How does he put it? The Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. So what is Jesus' perspective? He doesn't take the rejection of him personally. He doesn't decide to personalize it and decide, you are rejecting me, that hurts me, therefore I want you to be hurt. Instead, he has a kind of objectivity toward their evil. They're not rejecting him, they're just being themselves. They're being the God-hating, God-rejecting, truth-rejecting people that they are. And people like that need to be delivered from their evil, delivered from their sin, saved from the destruction that is their due, not destroyed. An incredible response, a response that should rebuke every one of us, because that's not our response. Our response is first to always personalize rejection to start with, which is the beginning of the problem. We personalize rejection to start with, and then we readily adopt the attitude, people that reject me ought to be destroyed. I want them destroyed. Or at least to hurt for a while. We're nicer. So Jesus is responding to them not out of their ostensible motivation, their theology. He's responding to them out of the actual spiritual condition. And notice the way he puts it, you know not of what sort of spirit you are. It's not the spirit of Christ that characterizes their spirit. It's the spirit of the devil that characterizes their spirit. And he's saying, listen to yourselves, you guys. Listen to yourselves. Where's this coming from? What is it in your heart that you would be willing and that you would find it desirable that God destroy the whole village instead of God mercifully and patiently waiting for them to repent that they might be saved? What do you think? What are your values? Where are you coming from? So let me make a couple of comments just to expand on that a little bit further. Three things here, I think, are going on in James and John, and I'm going beyond the text here, I understand this, but I'm exegeting my own life, my own psychology, my own being, which I think is also your own being. I think we have to remember how fundamentally evil it is to take personal offense at any and every little thing that people do and say that we at least perceive to be and believe to be some sort of slight for us. That's evil. We justify it because we believe that we're so discerning, that we are so capable of seeing what people are really thinking and what they're really saying. But one of the most important things, and one really nice thing, is to be blessed with a lousy memory so you can't remember when you've been insulted. But if God has not blessed you with a lousy memory, the next best thing is to be able to take the perspective that when people are insensitive to me, they don't acknowledge me, they don't respect me, they don't give me the honor that is my due. And they may not be. I mean, it's very, very possibly, very likely the case that they are not giving me the honor that is my due. That may very well be true. But why are they not doing it? Are they not giving me the honor that is my due because they're thinking of me and wanting to deny me? Mostly not. Mostly they're too preoccupied thinking about themselves to even be thinking about hurting me. They're not even that outside of themselves. More often than not, when I'm disrespectful or I insult you or I am sarcastic toward you or something, I'm not thinking about you. I'm thinking about myself. I'm protecting myself. I'm trying to exalt myself. I'm trying to be clever. I'm trying to do something that's about me and advancing me and exalting me and honoring me because of my own fears, my own insecurities, my own struggles with who I am. And that's what motivates me more than you do. So I don't mean to hurt you. I just mean to exalt me. But unfortunately, on the receiving end of that, we're inclined to take that insensitivity and that thoughtlessness and so on and take it personally and decide to be pained by it, to be wounded by it, to be hurt by it. And then it's out of that hurt that natural evil response of hurting back comes from. He hurt me. Oh, yeah. Two can play this game. And I'm going to hurt back. I think that's what's happening with James and John. They have taken this personally. And it's not about them. It's about God. It's about truth. It's about the self-centeredness and the self-absorption of the Samaritans. I mean, it's about all kinds of things, but it's not about James and John. And yet, this desire to hurt, I think, comes out of a perception on their part that this was some kind of personal slight that deserves to be responded to. The other thing is, when I take things personally, it's an indication, I think, of some deep-seated pride in me. We would respond much differently to the disrespect that other people show us if we didn't have an exaggerated sense of our own importance. Oftentimes, the perceived disrespect comes from taking ourselves too seriously. If I have the perspective that in the grand scheme of things, objectively before God, I'm just a creature. I'm just one more element of God's creation. I'm a remarkable creature. That's true. I don't have to ignore how wonderful as I am as a human being. I'm not talking about some kind of false sense of self-denigration. Yes, I'm a wonderful creature, but I'm just a creature. And you know, Matt, how many billions of wonderful human beings there are out there? There's billions of them. And every one of them is just as important to God as I am. When I'm able to take that perspective and recognize that any grace that I receive, any blessing that I receive, any honor that I receive, anything that happens that's desirable to me that I receive is a grace from God, is a gift from God. He doesn't owe it to me. And you don't owe it to me. There's a sense in which you do. You have a moral obligation too, but I shouldn't demand it of you. I think you've already talked about this, but the passage in Philippians that it just has really struck me. Look, Logan helped me see the real meaning of this. That Jesus, have this mindset in you that was in Christ Jesus, that although he existed in the identity of God himself, he did not regard the identity of God to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking on the form of a bondservant and so on. And the important thing to recognize is that Paul is not talking about the act of the incarnation. Paul is talking about after the incarnation has occurred, the God incarnate in Jesus Christ walking down the streets of Galilee. What do you see in him? You don't see him expecting people to bow and scrape to him. You see him as just one of the guys, in a way, who is just one man among other men serving other men. And he doesn't expect anything at all from those other people in terms of them honoring him, thanking him, being intimidated by him, bowing and scraping to him, and so on and so forth. He was quite the opposite of that. It was up to God to honor him, and not up to himself to demand that you honor him. And Paul is saying, have the same mindset that was in Christ Jesus. That should be our mindset. That I don't demand of other people that they honor me. You don't have to acknowledge me. You don't have to appreciate me. You don't have to tell me how great I am and let me know how great I am. If I take that attitude, I am not of the Spirit of Christ. It is some other spirit within me. Because the Spirit of Christ is to be quite content to leave any of the honoring business up to my Creator, up to God. And you don't need to do anything. I'll just get on with my life. And if you appreciate me, fine. If not, that's fine too. It's up to God. But there's this evil seed in us, the spirit within us, that grasps, that lusts after honor and respect of other people. And it lusts after it so much that we will grasp it and demand it and try to manipulate people for it. And we're after that at all costs. That's not the Spirit of Christ. The other thing I think I want to point out, and this I don't think you can really find this in the text here in this event with James and John, but as I look at my own life, it's also important to realize that when I have perceived that other people have disrespected me, and I allow myself to be hurt by it. And I do think we allow ourselves to be hurt by it. We allow ourselves to embrace a certain perspective from which it hurts. I can reject the perspective and not have to, and I can mute the pain of the disrespect if I take the right perspective. But by not allowing ourselves to take the right perspective and allowing ourselves to be hurt by the disrespect for others, then I think we lose all objectivity. And we don't even see those other people right. I mean, obviously, if there are people that I think should be destroyed by God from fire out of heaven, I'm not thinking very highly of them. And I don't think I'm thinking about them very objectively. All I see is the hurt that they've done to me. And now everything that they do justifies them being hurt. They are evil. They are perverse. They are proud. They are selfish. They're motivated by wrong motives. Everything about them and everything about their lives is wrong. That's the way I perceive them. Well, why do I perceive them that way? Not because I'm really making an objective evaluation of who they are. It's just my pain speaking. my pain has given me the lenses through which I'm looking at everything that they do and say. Nothing good, nothing at all good comes out of our evil response to people rejecting us. And that we need to learn the wisdom to take the disrespect and rejection of others in perspective, in the perspective that the Bible gives us, not allow ourselves to be hurt by it and not allow our perception of other people to be distorted by the hurt that they cause us. I do want to make one other comment here. I think it's important to see that John and James in this account are not just venting. Forgive my language here. I don't mean this frivolously. I'm not swearing. I mean this quite literally. But James and John are not saying, "God damn those stinking Samaritans," out of frustration. That's not what's happening here. I think Jesus rebukes them because their response is, as I said earlier, is sort of the settled desire of their heart. They really want the village to be devoured. I think we have to be really careful when we evaluate the settled desire of a person's heart, that we evaluate them not by the words that come out of their mouth, but by their actions. If I were to be judged by the words that come out of my mouth, God save me. I guess that's true, but if I were to be judged by the words that come out of my mouth, it wouldn't capture the real settled commitments of my heart, I don't believe. I just have this image of my grandfather. I grew up in Staten, and my grandparents lived about a block away from the Catholic Church. My grandfather was a Scottish Presbyterian, born and bred Scottish Presbyterian. And I just remember sitting in the living room playing, and he would go over to the living room window and look down the street at the steeple of the Roman Catholic Church down, and would just mumble under his breath all kinds of mean, nasty things about Catholics. But I never for a second believed that he had any real ill will toward any real Catholics, any real people. Because the sort of man he was, my prediction would be that if there were a Catholic in that town in need, my grandfather would have been there to help him. It was a strange disconnect between what he seemed to say that he believed and how he actually lived. Well, it's one thing to say, "God damn those stinking Samaritans." It's another thing to want fire to come down from heaven and devour them. In our frustration, whatever the nature of that frustration is, in our frustrations, we vent all kinds of frustration about other people and say all kinds of mean, nasty things about other people. But that's not the critical issue. The critical issue is, would you die for them? If I'm able to look past their weaknesses, their failings, their moral failings, their unworthiness, and act toward them as Jesus would want me to act, that's the crucial thing. That's the crucial issue. Now, I'm not justifying what we say in our frustration, because what we say in our frustration does reveal my moral condition. It does reveal evil within me. But I think we've talked here about the levels at which evil occurs in us. There's evil at the level of my heart and the commitments of my heart, and then there's the deep down evil that is in my being itself. Well, in my frustration, I will say things, and bubbling up out of my being itself is going to come the evil that is in fact there. But if I'm a disciple of Jesus, That evil bubbling up through the words of frustration doesn't mean nothing. Because if I'm a disciple of Jesus, the commitments of my heart are to a whole different vision of what it means to be a human being. I'm committed to being a different kind of human being, the kind of human being that Jesus was. I will serve. I will love. I will be merciful. I will be forgiving. I will do good, even to people who frustrate me. So I'm not justifying what we say, but I think it's very important that we not judge the commitments of another person's heart by what they say in frustration. We judge the commitments of their heart by what they do, not by what they say. It's kind of a cheap target to get on my self-righteous, pharisaical high horse and criticize people because they didn't speak kindly of someone else. Well, that's not very loving. Well, Jack, that's not very loving. Well, I know it. Of course it wasn't very loving. I was ticked. But it's an easy target, but it's a cheap target because it doesn't ask the further question, did you mean it? Are you really speaking the way you would act? What you're committed to doing to them and the way you're committed to behaving toward them? It's how I'm committed to behaving toward people that is the real indication, the real fruit of my commitments. Well, I guess I'll stop there because we're running out of time and then we're at the end of that section. So questions or comments?
I appreciate you not mentioning me by name this Sunday. And we laugh because it's funny, but it's not that funny. So I assume the objectivity you described was, I mean, everything else, spot on. Really good show. The objectivity that you describe is, I assume, is through empathy. I mean, when we are hurt by another person, we become objective not because we subtract ourselves from subjective existence, but because we can put ourselves in the minds and experiences and insecurities of our enemy, we'll use it that way, and understand that not just that I hurt people as they hurt me, but similarly that they don't intend hypothetically to hurt me, even though it sure looks like they do. But the muting of emotions I find improbable, if not existentially impossible.
Well, stop.
Yeah.
Translate.
Muting of emotions, it was your phrase. If we can objectively understand that people do not inherently necessarily, even though, again, it seems like they seem to do us harm, seem to hurt our feelings or tread on our toes, we can objectively somehow, I don't know you don't mean this, especially when I'm going to say it, you're not going to agree with it, transcend emotional pain.
Oh, okay.
And
right.
So it strikes me that the nature of forgiveness has to come also with the absolute brutal cuttings that we receive from the people who we both love and hate.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm not saying, I'm not a Buddhist. You know, we're not trying to transcend our feelings and our emotions and overcome them and be beyond them. We need to pass through the pain of our lives. The pain is going to be there. I think that's guaranteed. I think that's promised. But in the midst of the pain, can we get the perspective that allows us to get the objectivity to not have it being a catalyst for us responding evilly and wanting to destroy. That's what I'm getting at.
And I really appreciate that and your whole talk in general. That's fabulous.
Thank you.
Yeah, Jack, I had two questions. One is when he says you do not know what kind of spirit you are of, people would like to look at that and either say, okay, James and John aren't Christians here, or they might say James and John aren't in the spirit here. The first question is if you could elaborate a little bit on this, what kind of spirit you are of. And then my second question is, this also would be a common phrase for radical pacifists to use and put Jesus in the camp of he's anti-war, never raise the sword in any way. Could you comment on those two things in terms of interpretations of this verse?
Let me take the last one first. I think when I talked about James and John's position being theologically right, I think it's important to recognize that's true. I mean, from a strictly objective point of view, could God have judged this Samaritan village for what they did in the way that they want him to judge him? Absolutely. I mean, there's no question about that. And I don't think Jesus is denying that. So it's not the Jesus of Revelation is not a pacifist. I mean, when he comes to set the world right, and when he comes to judge the world, He's going to judge the world in violence. He's going to destroy. So as a text for pacifism, I just think it misses the whole point of what Jesus is doing in interacting with James and John. He's not rejecting out of hand God's judgment, God's violent judgment of unbelief. He's rejecting James and John for their spirit, for their attitude. What's making them tick? It's important to see the distinction. Is he saying that they're not believers?
Or that they're not in the spirit at that moment? You know how there's that teaching of dichotomous, you know, you got to walk in the spirit. So James and John aren't walking in the spirit here.
Okay.
They're not believers.
I don't accept that interpretation of walking according to the spirit, walking according to this flesh. So that would be a whole message to interpret the passages that are used as proof texts for that. But no, I don't think we go in and out of the spirit. Either we have the spirit or we don't have the spirit as believers. It's possible for us as believers to not walk according to the spirit. I think that's true. And if they are believers, I think that's what we see here, is that they're not really walking according to the Spirit. And what I understand that to mean is different than is typically taken. What I understand that to mean is you're not living your life in the way that Jesus instructed you to live your life, and out of the desires and passions and orientations that Jesus says you ought to have. Those aren't your desires and passions and orientations. We are not walking according to the instruction of the Spirit of God. That's one possibility, is that they are in fact believers and they're just like you and I. I can be authentically a believer but not live consistently out of what it is that I believe. I'm not mature. I don't know enough. I'm all kinds of reasons that my commitments are not settled enough, that my faith is mature enough that I'm living consistently with what I embrace. I think in the case of James and John, I don't have any problem at all coming to the conclusion that these guys aren't even believers yet. They're not even sanctified yet. And I don't know if that's the case, but I wouldn't have any problem with that. That you see this incredible change come over them on the day of Pentecost. An incredible change, like night and day, not getting it to getting it all of a sudden. So it may very well be that Pentecost was, if you were to translate Pentecost into our life, it was some kind of repentance and transforming conversion experience. But I don't know. I'm not sure. We go either way with that.
Okay, thanks.
I make the personal comment, it's sort of an interesting experience, Jack, for me to listen to you give a message like this, because Jack and I have known each other for probably 30 years and worked together for 27, 28 years, I don't know, something like that. So Jack knows perfectly well that the message that he gave this morning is particularly applicable to me, because one of the besetting problems of my life is a tendency to take personally those kinds of things. So I was listening real carefully to what it is you had to say this morning, and I thought it was really great. But because this is something I've wrestled with a lot, there's one thing that you said that made me stop, and I don't disagree with it. I think I do agree with what you're saying, but I invite you to say something about this. And it was at that spot when you were saying that it was pride that led to that response. Like I say, I mean, I'm in no position to disagree with that. I think that's probably true. But it seems to me that what I'm aware of being behind that sort of response is insecurity.
Right. Yeah.
And so what I'm inviting you to make a comment on is the connection between pride and insecurity.
Okay. Yeah. Good. It seems to me that all of our insecurity is ultimately rooted in a foundational sort of pride. And I don't know if I can unpack that very well. I mean, maybe somebody else can do a better job than I can. But it seems to me that it's kind of like our confronting Jesus' death on the cross. The gospel message is that God is going to be merciful. And yet, try as we might, we just have this incredible resistance to having my acceptance in God's eyes be a gift from him rather than some kind of worthiness. So I think there's a similar kind of relationship between pride and the insecurity that I experience, is that we have this resistance to my significance being, if you will, a gift from God. I mean, something that is given by God. And so we want it to be somehow inherently within me, which creates the insecurity, because I'm not sure it's there. That's the best I can do. Somebody else needs to help me. But I think there's some kind of relationship between my pride wants my significance on some other terms other than the terms in which they are objectively given to me, and I'm afraid I can't get it on other terms, which creates this incredible sense of insecurity.
We might make the distinction. I can hear Margaret thinking over here while as you're saying this stuff. You didn't know I could do that. But that distinction, if we're talking about inherent worth,
yes,
there's that distinction. What you were saying before is that I am a glorious creation of God,
right,
and there is a sense in which I have inherent worth. I am not nothing, but I'm kind of worse than not nothing. I'm a something that's gone really bad.
Right.
So,
right.
But and what I would like to do is somehow have my acceptance in what you're saying there be on the terms that people would acknowledge that somehow I'm not that bad, that
mm-hmm.
I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, but with that modification, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You said you could imagine that James and John were not actually believers saved at that point. Can you also imagine that they are saved? And the reason I ask this is someone who hadn't heard you teach before might have interpreted some of what you said as what separates believers from non-believers is that although we want to do bad things, we don't actually do them. We may say bad things, but we, when it push comes to shove, we don't actually act in a selfish way. We help the Catholics and whatever it is, whoever we're ticked off at. And I could imagine I can imagine that they are saved, and I think the thing that might, I think they probably genuinely wanted fire to rain down, which is definitely an indication of a spirit that's not Jesus' spirit. But after Jesus rebukes them, what's their response?
Right.
I would hope, I can imagine being myself in that situation where wanting to rain down fire and someone much more godly than me saying, wait a minute, you know, that's a real problematic attitude you have. And what I would hope I would do is sort of be cut up short. And if I am a believer, say, you're right, that's an appalling attitude.
Yeah.
That I have, and it was really there. I can't pretend that it wasn't there. That really was what I wanted. So, and if I were not a believer, I'd say, now give me a break. These guys, this
deserve
is the Son
it.
Of God, you know, I'm following him, you know, does you see a problem here? So,
yeah.
How does the desire of our heart, I mean, I think this really was the desire of their heart. Maybe it wasn't. And it was a commitment of their heart, so to speak, but maybe wasn't the settled commitment of their heart. Or?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and thank you. That's an excellent point. The other thing that we always have to keep in mind is that our lives are not judged by a snapshot, but it's by a moving picture, you know, the trajectory of our life. I think it's crucial to understand that for exactly the reason that you mentioned, that this could be a horrendous evil desire that has gripped their heart at this moment in time. But if Jesus rebukes it and they call it what it is and they agree with Jesus and go, yeah, that was awful, that's huge. That's a huge confession, a huge admission that has a significant implication for who they are and where they're at spiritually. Someone who wouldn't repent of it, if you will, wouldn't even confess it and acknowledge it for what it is, would try to downplay it or justify it or defend it or rationalize it. is far more likely an unbeliever than the person who at least in time, I mean, even if they immediately respond defensively and it takes them a few hours to come back and go, you know, you were right. That's huge. That's the stuff of sanctification is made of. Okay.
So let's say, you know, in my own life, it's not hypothetical, I have evil desires all the time, and for the most part, I don't have somebody standing alongside reading my mind, as Ron is able to do, saying, wait a minute, Margaret, you know, that's really appalling. So that the fact that on some occasions I may not be blessed with the presence of someone who can pull me up short and say, don't go there. That's really awful. Doesn't necessarily change the fact of who I am, hopefully the kind of person that if somebody were there to do that, I would say, you're right, this is God save me.
And in time, we'll look back on that and be able to, I mean, I think I've confessed it publicly here. I mean, one of the sins that I committed that I'm most ashamed of, it took me 2 decades to recognize I was wrong. But as I look back on it now, I go, incredible. I can't believe you were that evil. But I was just so horrified, I think, at myself that for years I was telling myself a story to defend why I had responded the way I had responded. I'm not all that mysterious. I'm sure I've told this story, but when I was a freshman in college, we had what's called a freshman seminar, where you take freshmen and put them with really hotshot academics, and we happened to be studying with a Nobel laureate, a Nobel Prize winner. It was called Mental Tools for Scientific Thinking, because I thought I was going to study physics at that time. And the guy was an ass, to put it accurately. And there was this one session that we were having where he was trying to explain something, and all of us were having difficulty grasping his explanation. But at a certain point in time, I thought I had an insight into what he was trying to say. And so I tried to feed it back to him, and he didn't recognize in what I was saying what he was saying, because I was totally off. He didn't recognize it. But a guy who was a dorm mate, who was also in the class, he began to see what I was saying, and his eyes got wide, and he got excited. Okay, I'm beginning to see this. And I was getting all kinds of nonverbal affirmation from him during this time. So the professor said, I don't know what Jack is saying. Does anyone understand what Jack is saying? And he said, I think I do. And he proceeded to give exactly the explanation that I was offering. I mean, he had understood me to the T. And when he finished, the professor turned to him and said, that is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. At which point, my once friend turned to me, his hands like this, as if pleading, please, please join me in my embarrassment, and said, well, I'm just telling you what Jack was saying. And the professor turned to me and said, Jack, is that what you were saying? And to my undying shame, I said, I'm not sure. Which was complete bull, because I was dead sure that that's what... he understood me perfectly. And I was such a coward at that moment that I deflected all that embarrassment back onto him and refused to share it. And the thing that's even worse than what I did is the story I told myself walking back to the dorm room. The story I told myself was, well, I'm not really sure that that's what I was, that he was right. And I think I lived with that story for decades until, you know, one day I was just trying to think of an example of how evil we are, and it just, I guess it was a divine message. It just popped into my head. Well, how about that, Jack? That was pretty evil. So I need to let you go. But, yeah, thank you. That's a great clarification.